Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in public health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is here today, an opportunity for you to get some insight, analysis, and commentary on the media issues of the week, and we hope you'll enjoy it, as well as get some edification. That's our goal. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, your genial host, as they say. Right here.
Is this a game show?
Ira Fussbaum.
But I love the idea that the editor is saying edification.
Edification, see, yes, absolutely. That's one of those great words. It's like the Spanish word for journalist I mentioned is periodista, because it suggests to me that you're the period putter.
Oh.
That's what I do. I put in periods and take out commas. That's my job. I'm the periodista. Ira Fussbaum is here, longtime publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York.
Yeah, so am I be publisherista or publishification?
Publicador, something like that. I don't know. You don't say. And, of course, Dr. Alan Chartok, there in the posh hidden studio in the Berkshire Mountains of Massachusetts. Alan, how are you?
Well, I'm here. There's no use complaining. The only reason to complain about a busted ankle is that the more people you can annoy with your stories or your busted ankle, the more likely it is to heal. At least that's what I've always been thinking.
Okay. The more people you can annoy, I guess there's some formula.
But that just means that we don't have to get annoyed at any of the other stories that he typically tells.
That's right. There's no...
Right. There was the great moment when somebody said to Rex, why don't you reach across the table and just smack him?
Moment. Many moments that's happened. People suggest that all the time.
This prevents that from happening.
That's good. That's there he is. All right. So it's been a wonderful few days. And of course, the world has not yet calmed down from the tweet storm on a Saturday night or early in the morning on a weekend when the president of the United States accused his predecessor of illegally spying on him during the campaign. And the difficulty of covering this, of course, is that some of it seems outrageous. How do you cover, as a journalist, something that may well border on being disconnected from reality?
Well, I think the media has done quite well by covering it and describing it just that way. The headlines emphasizing that he's making these claims without any evidence, and the reporting subsequently has not been shy in repeating that and saying that there's simply no truth and that people around him don't know what he's talking about and that he has uncharacteristically remained quiet after this initial barrage, suggesting that he knows he made a big mistake.
I was just going to say, never has there been a time when journalism has been more important. I mean it, because clearly the House of Representatives and the Senate are absolutely convinced that they should not do anything by way of investigating. And if it's going to be investigated, any of these things that Trump has said that just seem to be not true, they're going to endanger their own political longevity. So the House, which is an oligarchy, if there ever was one, and the Senate, which is ruled by Mitch McConnell, whose wife is in the Trump cabinet, is really not going to do the job. So it's going to be up to journalism. Now, my prediction, of course, it being later than New Year's, but my prediction has always been that when it comes down to impeachment or anything like it, it's going to have to do with the Russians. And since the House and the Senate won't do the investigations, then it's going to have to be the media. And it's going to have to be the kind of work that the Times, the Washington Post, CNN, which has really risen to the occasion, is going to have to do.
But, you know,
that's the end of my
Rex's question was, how does the media handle this particular story? I think we all agree they've done quite well so far. I think the bigger problem, the expanded problem, is how do you handle this particular story in light of the fact that every day there seems to be three or four more equally as important, challenging, ridiculous stories that also need to be covered? And that sort of plays to what many think Trump's strategy is with the Obama charges, and that is he's distracted us from other things, and now he's going to get other stories that are going to distract us from that. And so that story, he hopes, will slowly fade away.
It becomes a media issue because you notice this, for example, in cable news, which can only cover one story at a time. You know, it's not like a newspaper where you've got five or six stories on the front page. If you're watching a cable newscast, there's this story, then there's this story. And it is much more compelling to cover this than it is the healthcare debate, which is issue-oriented, complex, thick. And so you can see the cable channels sticking with it. And look at, here we are today talking about this ridiculous distraction. So do we think that's intentional, or is it just the president flying off the handle?
Both.
That's the big question, all right. There are many people who think he's just really off the wall and that he may be a little unstable. There are many people who think that he may be some kind of an evil genius who has thought all of this out and knows that the more he can do this, the more he could get something like the ACA or Obamacare killed in the Congress while everybody's talking about his untruthful tweets. So we don't know the answer.
Now, here's a question for you, Alan. You've often expressed your unhappiness with the state of libel law in this country. What would happen if Barack Obama sued Donald Trump for libel? What do you think about that?
Well, you know the law, Ira knows the law, and I know the law. The Supreme Court of the United States, New York Times versus Sullivan, made it quite clear that you have to show actual malice.
Or reckless disregard for the truth if you're a public figure. Right.
Right. It's very, very hard to do. And there is an old saying about getting into a urinating contest with a skunk that may apply here. You don't want to do that. And if you're Obama, you're a man of great dignity, you're a man who showed great decorum, you want to start making this lawsuit. But it must be tempting. It really must be tempting. And as you say, it's a marginal kind of call on the court's part. We're about to have a new Supreme Court justice, I suspect, put onto the court. It's going to be a majority for the conservatives. People know who appointed them. I don't know. Those are some of my thoughts on it.
I would say I would have thought that Obama, as a former president, really wouldn't be able to get a libel case moved along very quickly. But wouldn't it be ironic if Trump, who vowed during his campaign to loosen up the libel laws, loosened up the libel laws to the extent that the former president would be able to sue him for libel?
I think he could do it now, notwithstanding the fact they're both big public figures. Look, the statement was false and defamatory.
And reckless.
And it was made with reckless disregard for the truth. It would be a hell of a good story to cover. We can only wish, right?
Well, one can only hope that Trump gets what's coming to him for doing this kind of reckless stuff. I would remind you both, in an even bigger potential story, is here's the North Koreans firing stuff into the Sea of Japan, and here's the guy with his finger on the button, Trump. So if you're reckless, that would be a hell of a story.
Huge stories for us to cover, and it is very difficult. You're right, when we have all of this distraction, all this jazzy stuff.
I mean, the broader question, and it's less a media story, but it's everything is interconnected, is that he repeatedly lies, which he has done for over 2 years and for most of his public life. And using this Obama story as the most recent example, where it's clear that he is not telling the truth, what can we believe that comes out of this guy's mouth, particularly when he's trying to talk to the American people about something that's very serious and is, by the way, true? Are we going to believe him? I think a lot of Americans are going to believe he's Chicken Little.
But here's the issue. Here's a new Quinnipiac poll that has something of an answer to that. Now, when you compare trust in the media to trust in Trump, here's an interesting thing. 53% of Americans trust the media over Trump. Okay, that's a majority, but still 37% trust Trump over the media. In fact, 81...
Those are the 37% who voted for Trump, by the way. And that number hasn't moved. That number has not moved.
And 81% of Republicans agree that the news outlets are the enemy of the American people. I find that astonishing, because that accusation, enemies of the people, seems to me to be such an outrageous thing. Now, overall, the population overall, people disagree with that 59% to 38%. Now, that's a new Quinnipiac poll again. But still, if 81% of Republicans think that we are enemies of the American people, what then does that portend for this notion, as Ira mentioned earlier, that what we just have to do is keep reporting the truth and eventually the truth will out?
Well, those numbers are what they are. The other numbers are circulation digitally and in print for New York Times and Washington Post and other newspapers is way up. The ratings of the cable news networks, particularly the vaunted and much hated on the Trump side, CNN, is through the roof. Did you notice that? I think Jeff Zucker said CNN bottom line profit last year, $1 billion, and expects to be better this year because the Trump administration is helping them drive ratings. So people are tuning in, and I'm not saying that if they don't believe us that that doesn't matter because they're tuning in, but I suspect that people are tuning in because they want to find out what's going on.
You know, it's very interesting, because let's assume for a second that Trump is a potential despot, and I think he is. What do despots always do when confronted with falling public perception? They cause a war, and I'm frankly scared to death about that one. Because that's when the bands start to play and the kids start to march, and we've all seen it before. And you have the perfect provocation in North Korea doing what they're doing, and his picking on China from day one, and I really mean picking on Chinese in a way that I think is just, you know, while he's making love to the Russians, he was picking on China. So what happens if and when that kind of gambit occurs? Will the press have the whatever to be able to oppose such a thing?
The authority, the credibility in the eyes of the American people. And I don't think he has to actually cause a war, because it seems very likely that the tensions that are out in the world are going to get more potent by these actions that are now underway. And as the Western alliance that has held together throughout the post-World War II era begins to fray, seemingly with the encouragement of the White House, there is more reason for adventurism by those who wish us ill. So I think there is a very real possibility of conflict that could be very dangerous. And your question's well put. How can you challenge a drive toward war if you don't have widespread credibility?
And that he's also, let's not forget, pouring in how many billions of dollars in his budget to increase military spending?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. By the way, one of the interesting things when you're talking about the international scene is the role of Rex Tillerson, the new Secretary of State, the former CEO of ExxonMobil. I don't know if you saw the really interesting video of Andrea Mitchell of NBC News trying to get a question to the Secretary of State. You know, he's really been insulated from the press, aside from his little opening remarks to the staff in Foggy Bottom. I don't think he's appeared or taken any questions. And so Andrea Mitchell, in a photo op a couple of times, tried to shout questions, and the Secretary of State pretended not to hear them, ignored them, and twice in recent days, the staff around the Secretary of State kind of physically pushed her out of the way.
Bill O'Reilly called her unruly.
Unruly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, historically in Washington, D.C., certainly in recent decades, the State Department has held a daily briefing, whether or not it was with the secretary, that there was a daily briefing, and the White House has held a daily briefing. There has been only one, to my knowledge, briefing, and it was only this week, as we speak, in the State Department. And the White House briefing has been in and out, sometimes before the cameras, sometimes not, sometimes keeping reporters out, sometimes not. So the level of transparency, the Trump administration's claims to the contrary, has been not very strong.
It is amazing when Sean Spicer meets with the press, he refuses to allow cameras in. The White House Correspondents Association has objected to this. This kind of behavior in previous administrations, if this had happened during the transition between George W. Bush and Barack Obama, there would have been quite an outcry. But there is so much for the press to object to. And the American people have gotten inured to the sort of anti-press activity, of course, that the complaints that the cameras are being excluded from White House briefings, the public doesn't seem to care about it. There's just a general shrug.
It's one of the problems of our democracy. The less people know, the less active they get. We have seen it 100 times, and these guys are on to it. As for me, every time I see Sean Spicer up there, I think of Saturday Night Live.
Absolutely.
And, By the way, it's not as humorous a suggestion as it might be, because I think Saturday Night Live has really entered the political dialogue. The New York Times puts the latest stuff and the access to it for those of us who go to sleep early on the front page of the paper all the time. And we see it over and over again. So when I see that guy up there, I'm thinking about the actress playing him.
Yeah, and call him Melissa the way that Bill Maher does. Yeah, hey, Melissa.
Yeah, but you know, that's really cool. But you know, Saturday Night Live is dating all the way back to when Chevy Chase used to fall over and imitating the bumbling Gerald Ford. There has been that kind of thread, but the current version has been much more sharp and it's been much more pervasive throughout their program. If you noticed in the last program, again, as we speak, they didn't say it, but throughout the program, there was Kate McKinnon dressed as Kellyanne Conway sitting in various places on the set with her legs tucked under her on the cell phone. They didn't say anything, but they had her like Where's Waldo throughout the program.
And it's clear that the Trump people respond to it by their either calling off the Spicer hearings for a while, or, you know, the meeting of the press in the morning. So it's clear that this stuff is having an effect on them. They don't know what to do with it.
Well, by the way, they're not doing themselves any favor, but in sending out people to speak to the TV press, they're sending out the deputy press secretary, who is Mike Huckabee's daughter, who was a surrogate throughout the campaign. She wasn't a terribly effective one then. She is not an effective one now. She clearly is not able to defend the indefensible, and she's not very good at deflecting. And it's just for her to be the face of the administration. It's just, again, speaks to so many problems in that administration.
If you're just joining us, you need to know that this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. The last speaker there was Ira Fussfeld, a longtime publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York. Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, is off in his studio in the Berkshires with his ankle elevated. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union in Albany. And if you want to offer your thoughts, send it to us at media@wamc.org. media@wmc.org, and we will try to make your comments a part of our program next week, which would be a good thing. We need to talk about a couple of other issues. One is this. Here's interesting news. Politico has become the latest newsroom to remind reporters to write shorter. The Washington Post has done it. The Wall Street Journal has tried to cut it down. And this is a problem that I have to tell you that a lot of editors can identify with. Politico is telling its reporters most daily stories should not run longer than 1,000 to 1,100 words. My reporters would be delighted if I would encourage that length. We would say 700 words is about our limit. And it is a difficult issue because there's a lot to say, right?
It surprises me in this day and age where you have a print component and then you have the digital component. Now, if you're telling me that Politico doesn't have a print component, if the Albany Times Union wants to limit, and I don't know what your limit is, but let's say for the sake of discussion, 500 words as your print limit, that doesn't mean that you can't have, and in fact, you might want to have 1,500 words to 2,000 words, depending on the story, in your digital edition. It complements the print edition. Certainly, two reasons why the stories need to be shorter in print is, one is there simply is not as many pages as there used to be. And second, we know that reader attention spans don't hold up. In fact, it's one of the reasons why years ago, people were loath to take stories on page one and continue them inside, because people were not turning the page to find the story inside. But I just think that to have a blanket shorter story limit when you have digital editions is making a mistake.
Well, the other thing is that even the TV people are saying 60 Minutes and everybody else, you want more on this? Go to 60minutes.com or whatever it is, and we will fill in the rest of the story. Now, as for me, I've been writing a political column on state politics, basically, and one in the Berkshire Eagle, a separate one. And I keep those to 650 words. And if you start to think in 650 words, you can get an awful lot of information into that time. You know, President Eisenhower used to say, no more than a half a page, and you can get it all in on a half a page. I have a feeling he had something to say there. He knew what he was talking about.
attention span is, I think, the issue more than newsprint, although Ira's right, we have fewer pages. But I think it really is true that people don't read as much as they used to. And we've always, in the media, assumed that people are reading our stories. And it turns out, if you look at the research, they look at pictures first, headlines second, captions under photos third, and only then will they pay attention to the story. And then a tiny percentage of people jump from the front page to the inside.
Is there any research that has been brought up to date, given the lessening of circulation, that the people who still do buy newspapers are people who are interested in reading and thus would be more tolerant of longer stories?
That's an interesting
question. And older.
Yeah. Well, we know they're older, and so they have a habit. You know, again, when I open up the New York Times and I start a story and I go inside and see that it's jumped over two full pages, if it's something that I'm interested in, man, I say, this is why I buy the New York Times. And I wouldn't want to see that story relegated to 500 words.
Well, some stories have to be long. The issue that you pursue is you let some stories be short so that you have room for the ones that have to be long, and you don't give people unnecessary length. Or, as Alan suggests, you send people on to... and this is actually part of the formula that Politico is advising their people on. They're saying provide at least two suggestions for tweets or Facebook posts beyond the story's headline on every story. They want to get people to use social media and get people to look at more stuff and offer additional headlines. This is actually another one of the tricks that we often use. We'll, you know, divide a story into multiple pieces so that it's not a big, long chunk of type, so that you actually have a sidebar.
So should we credit, some of us may be hesitant to credit, but it may be that the most influential print newspaper in the last half century was USA Today.
Yeah.
Which introduced color photography, shorter stories, graphs and charts, and everybody went that direction.
Our brains are connected, Ira, and I hate that because I was about to make that same profound point.
Well, I don't know if USA Today has created this trend or if it just happened to capitalize on it. It was created at a time when the American consciousness had finally been so shaped by television that newspapers had to become more colorful, shorter, with quicker reads and more visual.
Yeah, but I can tell you that particularly as it relates to color photography, they really pushed the old line. I mean, there was not a lot of desire to spend money on new presses and new print technologies until USA Today showed that it could be done. Part of the reason was that color in newspapers was not very good, and USA Today showed that it could be good, and it pushed us all there.
I wanted to ask Rex a question, or Ira, either of you who may have the answer, or neither of you if neither of you have the answer, and that is when you go from, here's an old man, me, I'm an old man now, okay, but I'm really 40, but my birth certificate says I'm 75.
Okay. Yes, sir, youngster, go right ahead.
Right. And so my question is this. I don't read the newspapers anymore. Only on the weekend we take the Times because, as we say, we take the Times because I like to read that real estate section and find out what everything is worth. However, however, I have completely made the transition to digital. I mean, I read the New York Times three times each night. When I wake up, I read the Times. I go back to sleep. I wake up, I read the Times. And, you know, what's in the paper the next day is not always reflective of what you're seeing online because things change. So I'm wondering, Rex or Ira, if either of you know what the transference point for old people like me is. Are people moving over to digital who were reading the newspaper in the old days?
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. There is definitely a transition, even among older readers, to digital. I'm one of them, too. You know, I mean, I get 9 newspapers in my office every day because it's my line of work. But I read.
What are you, 40 now? Are you 40,
roughly,
40 years old
roughly
now? What
40.
Are you?
I'm about your age, too.
You know what? The New York Times, in my view, also has the best digital product. I find it the most comprehensive, the easiest to traverse. And
there are
a lot of good digital sites out there, but I find I'm always disappointed when I read a digital newspaper because I think I've missed something. We're out of time.
Time is up, so we end with the quote of the day here. This is from Ida Wells, African-American journalist and activist, who said this: "The people must know before they can act, and there is no educator to compare with the press." That's the Media Project for this week. Ira, Allen, and Rex, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.
upon a living stage now. Newspapermen are such interesting people.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Chartok is CEO of WAMC, Professor Emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. And Ira Fussfeld is the publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now, publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.